Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Remember when cars just had lap belts instead of the seat belts that also go across your body? Manufacturers installed those lap belts for decades with the intention of protecting people from harm in the event of a crash. But when they were shown to be causing spinal injuries, lap belts were radically redesigned. The new seat belts took a little getting used to, but they also did a much better job of serving their intended purpose, preventing crippling injuries in accidents. Well, what if laws designed to protect people from the harms of prostitution, disease, degradation, and physical abuse were actually doing more harm than good? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Some researchers who have studied the sale of sex for money have found evidence that outright bans on adult prostitution might be like those old lap belts, intended to protect but more likely to harm, even when everybody involved is an informed and willing participant. Allison Bass is here to explain. She teaches journalism at the Reed College of Media at West Virginia University. Her new book is called Getting Screwed: Sex Workers and the Law. Allison, welcome to Think.
It's good to be with you.
Who becomes a prostitute in America?
Well, it's a very wide range of women and men. It ranges from women who are paying their way through school and they need to pay their way with tuition, to people paying off student loans, to women who are raising families and are single mothers and need to do it for economic reasons. So it ranges from very high-end escorts, middle-class escorts, all the way to streetwalkers, some of whom are addicted to drugs and are strolling on the streets to pay for their next fix. So there's a very wide range of women involved and also men. There are many men involved as gay escorts in street work, almost as many as women.
I have to tell you, I was struck by the number of women who appeared in your book who have moved back and forth from legal employment, like office and sales jobs, to sex work. It seems like some treat sex work as a source of surplus income when they need cash in the same way that other people might take a job waiting tables temporarily.
Well, that's very true. I mean, one example I use is of Anna, who works in one of the legal brothels in Nevada. Nevada is the only state in the nation that allows some prostitution in brothels in its rural counties. And Anna couldn't get a job during the recession. She lived in Florida, and she couldn't even get a job at Wendy's. So she started working at one of the upscale brothels, and she was able to pay off her student debt, and she just wished she'd gotten into it earlier, so she told me. She has since left and is now married, or actually she was already married, and her husband supported her in what she was doing, and she has a child, and she's raising the child back in Florida.
Is it reasonable to say that most prostitutes working with a brothel are safer, relatively speaking, than those who are managed by a pimp or working the streets?
Well, you have the legal brothels, okay, and that's in Nevada, and those are very safe, secure environments because they're closely monitored, and nobody, as one sex worker who worked there said, nobody gets out of line because they'll get pounced on immediately. So those are very safe environments, and there are also places where women are tested for sexually transmitted diseases. Since that testing has been implemented, there hasn't been a case of HIV, and this is since the 1980s, in the legal brothels. In the illegal brothels, and I went into several in Midtown Manhattan, again, there are security on hand and the clients are screened. The brothel owners know who the clients are. They know where they work. They have their credit card information, and there's really very little problems with the clients. Occasionally, as one madame said to me, someone might ask for bareback sex, in other words, sex without condoms, and the answer is absolutely no. All the sex in that brothel has to be with condoms. And if they give anybody a hard time, they're bounced right out of the brothel. So there's a lot of security in some of these brothels. Now, it is more dangerous. There's no question that it's more dangerous to work on the street where, you know, you have an individual woman or man who's negotiating for safe sex with a client. And sometimes they don't know who they're getting into cars with. And that's what makes laws criminalizing prostitution so dangerous, because when in an illegal environment, they don't often have time because the client's afraid of getting arrested, the sex worker is afraid of getting arrested, so they don't often have time to negotiate safe sex, in other words, sex with condoms. And that's been found to be true in countries where it's illegal, while in countries where it's legalized and decriminalized, and this has happened in New Zealand, they say they have more time to negotiate safe sex and to screen the clients to make sure that they're not getting into the car with a serial killer.
Sex is entirely legal in America between any two consenting adults or more consenting adults. Sex for money is illegal almost everywhere. Is there anything else like this where the law tolerates a behavior unless one party to the activity pays the other?
No, this is it. And as far as many people in the trade feel, there's not much difference between an elderly gentleman like Donald Sterling, the former owner of the LA Clippers, paying a younger girlfriend millions of dollars to be his girlfriend, essentially, and somebody else just forking over some money for an hour or two of a girlfriend experience with a sex worker. A lot of people don't see much difference in that, but one is legal and one is not.
You are remarkably non-judgmental in the book. Was that the product of an evolution of your attitude and an effort to set biases aside, or did you go into this project thinking this is something that should probably be decriminalized?
No, I didn't go into thinking that it should be decriminalized. I didn't know much about sex work until I met my first sex worker, and I was really blown away by how intelligent and articulate she was. She came from a middle-class Orthodox Jewish background, and she was doing sex work because so she would have time to do her true passion, which was volunteering on behalf of disenfranchised people. She worked with the homeless, she worked with prisoners, and she worked with people with mental illness. And by doing sex work, she could work 10 hours a day instead of 40 hours a week. 10 hours a week instead of 40 hours a week, and spend the rest of her time doing what she cared most about.
How are the workers that you talked about, the sex workers, affected by their families' views on what they do, if in fact they tell them at all?
Some families know what the sex workers are doing and some don't. There still remains, in large part because it's illegal, enormous social stigma attached to being a sex worker. So that is the greatest fear of many sex workers. When I went into one of the brothels in Midtown Manhattan, I met Paris, that's her work name, who was attending Rutgers University and paying her way through school as a sex worker. But she was not about to tell her family what she was doing. And then there was Sarah, who, you know, was from Israel, and she was, again, paying her way through art college by being a sex worker. And when I asked her, does her family know, does her boyfriend know, and there was a big N-O to that answer.
Who is most likely to be criminally penalized for taking part in a sex-for-money transaction?
It's usually women and men at the lower end of the scale who are working on the street. And one of the biggest heartaches is you have teenage runaways, underage minors who have run away from homes where they may have been molested or abused or are uncomfortable because of their gay or lesbian identity, and they're selling sex for survival on the streets, and they get arrested when, in fact, they should be considered victims. And in fact, according to federal law, they are considered victims. But instead, in many cases, they get arrested and then re-traumatized by the criminal justice system. So the police are more likely to target streetwalkers, both underage and overage streetwalkers, and arrest them. They are less likely to target indoor sex workers, although that does happen, too. I mean, all sex workers live in fear of getting arrested.
To be clear, Allison, just in case it's not to our listeners, you're not talking about decriminalizing paid sex by minors. This is something that you think should remain illegal for the protection of people under 18.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, because as far as the law is concerned, I mean, they are not considered to be consenting to sex work, and they shouldn't be. And what we need to do, instead of putting the money into law enforcement to arresting these underage sex workers, is that we need to put more money into social services to help them with housing, education, support, and counseling, because, as I said before, a lot of them have been traumatized by previous instances. So absolutely, that I am only in favor of decriminalizing adult consensual prostitution.
We're speaking this hour with Allison Bass, who teaches journalism at the Reed College of Media at West Virginia University. Her new book is called Getting Screwed: Sex Workers and the Law. We'll resume our conversation with Allison in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Allison Bass.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Allison Bass, who teaches journalism at the Reed College of Media at West Virginia University and is author of the new book, Getting Screwed: Sex Workers and the Law. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or send me a tweet. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink. Allison, I want to talk about this issue of trafficking. To be honest, we've done a number of shows about how serious the problem is, how common it is. From your research would suggest that some of the concerns about trafficking may be misplaced. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, a lot of the statistics are way overinflated and grossly inaccurate. I interviewed somebody from the Coalition Against Trafficking Against Women when I was researching my book, and she said between 250,000 and 500,000 women and children are trafficked in the United States, and that's simply untrue, according to all the experts and researchers that I spoke to. No one really knows how many people are being trafficked, particularly into the United States, because there haven't been good counts either here or abroad. But it's much – in the United States, it's much, much lower than the figure that anti-trafficking groups bandy about. For instance, you have to also understand that trafficking includes anybody, any underage minor, anybody under the age of 18 who is caught doing paid sex is considered a trafficking victim by federal law. Okay. So one FBI study found that 1,400 minors had been arrested for prostitution in a recent year. Okay. Now, that, of course, is not the accurate number either, because that's just those who have come to the attention of law enforcement. But the number is far, far lower, both among women and children, than, as I said, the anti-trafficking groups bandy about. That doesn't mean it's not a problem. What's interesting is that trafficking has become the new name for what has been a decades-old problem of teenage runaways, girls and boys who leave home because they've been they're being abused or molested, or they feel uncomfortable because they're of their gay or lesbian identity. So they're moving to big cities and selling sex on the street for survival, and maybe they come to the attention of pimps. Now, according to a recent study that was done in New York, most of these underage prostitutes are not being pimped. They get into the trade to make money, to survive, and they're being introduced into it by friends. But there definitely are some pimps. So what used to be called a pimp is now being called a trafficker. It's simply a change in the names. And when I asked one of the executive director of an anti-trafficking group whether the name trafficking is confusing because it connotes movement. It connotes people being forced across borders, and that's not what's going on here. There are a small number of women who are being brought, illegal immigrants who are being brought trafficked, but most of them are coming in and doing prostitution for economic reasons because they can make more money than they can cleaning houses and doing one of the other low-paying jobs that are available to illegal migrants.
How does the criminalization of sex work interfere with the ability of sex workers to report if they are being abused or to escape from an abusive pimp or madam?
Well, basically, often I'll give you the example of Gary Ridgway, who was a serial killer in Washington State and who, by his own admission, killed upwards of 49 women, okay, mostly prostitutes but some non-prostitutes as well. Well, sex workers in Seattle knew that he was they had fingered him as the suspect, okay, because some of them had actually escaped from him when he tried to kill them. But they some of them went to the police and were ignored. Others were afraid to go to the police because they were afraid of being arrested. And that happens over and over again. It happened with the Long Island murders of a number of sex workers who were advertising on the internet and were all killed by, they think, the same person. They were afraid to go. In other words, the fear of arrest is what keeps sex workers from reporting and working with the police to target violent predators. And in countries where it's legal, like the Netherlands and New Zealand, sex workers feel comfortable going to the police and working with them. And as a result, there's less rates of violence against all women.
It has.
So that's one. That's the public safety aspect. I can also talk about the public health aspect.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, as I talked about previously, when sex work is illegal, sex workers are much less likely to take the time to negotiate safe sex and use condoms. They also have less access to good health care, so that raises the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. And again, in countries where sex work has been legalized or decriminalized, there are much lower rates of HIV. The Netherlands, in fact, has the lowest rate of HIV in the world.
And prostitution has been legalized, decriminalized for some time and legalized for a decade or more, right?
That's exactly right. It has been decriminalized since the 1970s and legal since 2000 there. Mm-hmm.
Another thing you write about that really I thought was interesting was this effort to get ads for paid sex out of the back of, you know, tabloid newspapers and free things that are distributed and even online. You make the point that some of that ability to sort of directly advertise to clients gives sex workers the opportunity to, for lack of a better term, you know, be in business for themselves rather than working under the management of a pimp.
That's absolutely right. That they have found that with the internet, the fact that sex workers can advertise directly to clients, there's been much less reliance on pimps. But when you try to shut down those websites, as state law enforcement and some federal authorities have tried to do, whether it's Craigslist or Backpage or now Rentboy, which is a site for gay escorts, you make it more difficult for sex workers to operate independently and to screen their clients themselves. And the other problem is that there are laws, some of the anti-trafficking laws, the police actually arrest sex workers who work together for safety reasons and charge each other with trafficking each other, which is a fallacy. Instead of going after true traffickers, okay, they're going after the sex workers. And this is happening in a number of states, including California, Ohio, Alaska, and other states, Virginia.
How much latitude do local law enforcement agencies and individual officers tend to have with regard to when and to what extent to enforce laws against sex for sale?
Well, it is completely done on the local basis. So in metropolitan police departments or in county sheriff departments, they decide how much they enforce the law. And what happens, like, for instance, in a place like Washington, D.C., it is streetwalkers and often minority streetwalkers who are the ones who are most often pulled in and arrested, okay? And the higher-end escorts are completely left untouched because there's a big business in Washington for sex work. One of the women I profile in my book by the name of Maddie, a 26-year-old blonde-haired beauty who comes from, as she describes it, a southern Mayflower country club family. She works in Washington, and a lot of her clients are top-ranking government officials and as well as corporate executives.
Are sex workers like Maddie, though, they're a small minority of sex workers in this country, are they not?
No, they're actually the majority.
Really?
There's a study that was done in New York that found that I think only 8% of sex workers had started underage and had been, you know, involved with pimps. The rest go into it for by choice, for economic reasons, and there are many more escorts, middle class and higher end escorts than we think. And in fact, according to another study, only about 2% of all sex workers are streetwalkers.
Is there any evidence that laws against prostitution prevent prostitution?
No, it's increasing. There's been a soaring demand for sex work. It's fueled by the internet. It's fueled by the global business, by this 24/7 work schedule. And there are a number of other trends as well that are fueling the demand for sex work. So laws against prostitution, the only thing they do is hurt sex workers and make it more difficult for them to protect themselves from both physical harm and from sexually transmitted diseases.
If you took police officers who are currently working vice assignments and had them devote their energies only to looking for evidence of abuse against sex workers or against their clients or abuse of minors, what kind of effort, I mean, what kind of energy would they have to devote to protecting people who are actually in danger?
Well, first of all, according to one of the best studies of what cities do in terms of spending their money on enforcing prostitution laws, found that the 16 largest cities in the United States spend more on enforcing prostitution laws, which is largely counterproductive because there are very few convictions, than they do on education and health care for their citizens.
Well, and what was the figure that you quoted? I think in the book it's something like there was a city that spent about $3,000 for every prostitution arrest it made.
That's right.
Yeah,
I think it was $2,000. Right. That's right. And but the overwhelming majority of sex workers are not convicted. They're just released and they have to pay fines. So it's kind of a money-making machine, but it's not certainly not stemming the surge in for demand in sex work or the supply of sex workers.
What are the pros and cons of trying to regulate legalized sex work in the same way that government regulates hygienic practices in like restaurants and beauty salons?
Well, I think the best model is the one that you can find in New Zealand. In 2003, New Zealand decriminalized all laws against adult consensual prostitution. So in other words, laws against trafficking and child prostitution remained on the books, as they should. At the same time they decriminalized the laws against adult consensual prostitution, they also began regulating venues of prostitution. So, for instance, the local municipalities get to decide where the brothels are located, not anywhere near schools or playgrounds, but places that are discreet and unobtrusive and not, as I said, in family neighborhoods. And they also have regular inspections. So if, for instance, an underage sex worker or a illegal immigrant is found to be working in those brothels, the brothel can be shut down. So that's how they regulate it. But the sex workers can pay taxes on their business, and they can describe themselves as independent consultants. They don't have to be tagged as sex workers. But so it allows them to work in much safer working conditions.
Allison Bass is my guest. She teaches journalism at the Reed College of Media at West Virginia University and is author of a new book called Getting Screwed: Sex Workers and the Law. Back in 2 minutes with Allison Bass.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Allison Bass, who teaches journalism at the Reed College of Media at West Virginia University and is author of a new book called Getting Screwed: Sex Workers and the Law. Join us at 800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. That's where we hear Allison from Mark, who asks if you can address the rentboy.com raid in New York City and why Homeland Security was involved. You know anything about that?
I do a little bit. I blogged about it shortly after it happened. I think that it's a tremendous waste of taxpayer resources to go after websites like rentboy.com. There was no evidence that there was any trafficking going on at those sites. It's simply a site where gay escorts can advertise and arrange liaisons with men who want to have paid sex. And it allows sex workers to be more independent, to advertise themselves instead of relying on pimps, to screen clients, and to arrange liaisons. And so, yes, it's true that they you could say the site was facilitating prostitution, but it was doing so in a very safe manner. And I don't understand. There are so many other problems in our society that need our attention. I mean, one of the problems I have with laws that criminalize prostitution is that we're putting our money into law enforcement to close down these websites, to arrest streetwalkers, to arrest sex workers, when the money should be going into social services to provide housing, education, and support, particularly for these vulnerable and marginalized women who are streetwalkers and underage sex workers. That's where we should be putting our focus, not on law enforcement.
Do you see a difference in terms of, you know, prostitutes who have a choice maybe and could do something else but want to do this, and those who, for whatever reason, feel that they don't have the education or the job skills or the connections to get a job that will support them and therefore feel as if their only option is selling sex?
I don't see a difference. I think that there's a spectrum between women who are doing it by choice for the flexibility, for the economic reasons. I mean, most women and men sell sex for economic reasons because they can earn so much more money doing it than in low-paid jobs at Walmart. And particularly for women, there are not – even college graduates, there are not a lot of good jobs out there anymore. And, you know, in terms of women who have to pay off student loans or are raising a family as a single mother – sex work makes sense because it provides a lot of flexibility and economic independence. So I think that, like I said, most people go into sex work for economic reasons, whether they are high-paid escorts or women who are doing it on the street.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Cheriesa in Irving. Hi.
Hi. My question is kind of, I don't know if it's a good one or not, but why is there such a negative, like, perception or stigma against sex workers? I was a sex worker for 5 years. I recently got out in 2012, and I've completely turned my life around, but still, like, I can't bring that up about my past to anyone, you know? So I just want to understand, like, why is it such a stigma now in this society when, like, in ancient Rome it wasn't, you know? Is it religion or, you know, that's kind of my question. Why is there still a stigma?
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question. And I think it's a long entrenched stereotype that has to do with there was a great paper that was written about the sociology of prostitution in the 1920s where they talk about societies and religious groups need to hold up marriage as something sacred, as a sacrament, because that's what leads to future generations, and they want to tie reproduction to marriage. Okay, so that's held up as a sacred institution. Well, there is no people aren't interested in reproducing when they go to a sex worker. They're interested in sex for pleasure. So that needs to be vilified. And it has been vilified very effectively by religious groups. And then over the centuries. And then you add into a more recent phenomenon, which is certain feminists who believe that sex work objectifies or commodifies women. And they fail to take into account that there are many women who like sex and are doing sex work because it fits into their lifestyle and their economic needs. And so they're just lumping everybody into one group. So I think that the religious groups have banded together with these what some call radical feminists to really vilify sex workers in recent decades and have conflated the issue of trafficking with prostitution by choice.
It is an interesting perspective among people who say they're fighting for the dignity and the rights of women to have a woman who is a prostitute say, I have chosen this, I want to do this thing, I'm safe and in control, and then tell that person that she can't possibly be making that decision in an informed way.
Well, that's very true. And that's what's happened in Sweden, where they're basically infantilizing and treating sex workers as children who can't make up their own minds about their bodies. And it's very difficult for women in Sweden. They lose custody of their kids, and that also happens in this country. They are treated very badly. They're discriminated against. And I think there is hypocrisy when you have feminists who are saying to women, oh, you can't make this decision.
Is it reasonable to argue that we should keep prostitution illegal because, generally speaking, our society has decided that paid sex is somehow distasteful and immoral, and that, you know, we have collectively decided that this thing should not be sanctioned by law?
Well, think about it. We live in a culture that basically accepts the implicit exchange of sex for money and status or even a good meal, right? You have a lot of women who go out with older men who pay for them, set them up in apartments, give them lots of money. But yet we impose heavy penalties on those who make such bargains explicit. And that, to me, is pure hypocrisy.
Do you think legalizing sex work, or is there evidence from places that have legalized or decriminalized, that that has any effect on the social stigma against it?
I think that it has some impact. There is still some social stigma to it, but it definitely has made life easier for sex workers in the Netherlands and in New Zealand, and they feel much safer. And so that's the beginning, okay? And then in a few years, hopefully there will be a culture shift. But it's going to take time because these attitudes about sex work have been centuries in the making.
Allison, can you talk a little bit about how you approached the people who became the subjects for this research project and your book, and how you established rapport and trust with them, given that they could maybe look you up online, but they didn't really know what you were going to say about them?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I was very lucky to have met my first sex worker. I was teaching in Western Massachusetts at Mount Holyoke College, and a student came to me for help with a draft assignment. I meet with all my students to go over drafts, and she was talking about an activist in Northampton, Massachusetts. And while we were discussing the profile and how to improve it, she suddenly blurted out, "She's a sex worker, you know." And I thought, that's interesting. She didn't end up talking about that in the profile because she was using the woman's real name. But later, after the semester was over, I decided to interview the woman. And I just, as I said before, this was Jillian, and I was very struck by how articulate she was and how much my conventional stereotype about sex workers was wrong. And so she spent a lot of time with me, and she put out the fact that I was interested in writing about this topic on a listserv, a private listserv to other sex workers. So sex workers around the country got in touch with me, and so it grew there. And, you know, I always was very clear with these women and men that I talked to that I don't need to use your real name. If you feel comfortable with me doing so, I will. And we negotiated what they felt comfortable with me talking about their lives and who they were. And so, yes, I treated them with respect. And I think they appreciated that.
Allison Bass teaches journalism at the Reed College of Media at West Virginia University. Her new book is called Getting Screwed: Sex Workers and the Law. Allison, thank you so much for making this time for us.
You're more than welcome. I enjoyed it.
Thanks.